Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning talk show, hour number two of the program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Our producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frain, is at the controls this morning. It was not so long ago that most American men served in the military. Today, however, that is not the case. There are a great many Americans who have no military experience. They have no family in the service. In fact, they may not even know anybody who is in the service or has been. And there are some people who are worried that something of a disconnect has developed in this country between America's civilian and military populations, that they are, in fact, beginning to be different, almost different cultures. In this hour of Focus, we will talk about the military and society, and our guest is John Allen Williams. He's professor of political science at Loyola University. We'll talk a little bit about who serves in the military and why, and also talk about the role that civil-military relations plays in U.S. foreign policy. And of course, as always, questions from people who are listening are welcome. Our guest, as I mentioned, John Allen Williams, is professor of political science at Loyola University, Chicago. He is chair and president of the Inter-University Seminar on Armed Forces and Society. He has written on a number of subjects, including civil-military relations, military culture, defense organization, strategic policy. He's a visiting scholar in the Department of Sociology at Northwestern University and is co-organizer and past president of the International Security and Arms Control Section of the American Political Science Association. He also is a former service person himself. He retired as captain in the U.S. Naval Reserve with 30 years of commissioned service. He is joining us this morning by telephone as we talk. Questions from people who are listening certainly are welcome. Again, as we always try to say at the beginning of each conversation, that callers is welcome, but we do hope that people will be brief in their comments just so we can keep moving along and get in as many different people as possible. But anyone's welcome. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers to call. Professor Williams, hello.
Good morning, David.
Thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure.
I am just curious, and I don't know if you can give a number like this, but do you have any idea what percentage of Americans living today have served in the military?
Oh, my, no. That's not a statistic kind of thing I have in the tip of my tongue.
Well, I'm sure, I would be certain that if we compared today with, let's say, 50 years ago, it certainly would have been, the percentage of Americans having served would have been much greater at that time.
Oh, absolutely. It's dramatically less. And there are a lot of reasons for this, but primarily we don't need that many people in the military as we've had in the past. Probably we need more than we have now. But we don't need the people that we had to staff a very large sort of industrial army like we had in the 50s and 60s.
Sure. Well, given the fact that we can certainly say that now there are few Americans who have served in the military, that we are indeed coming to a point where not only did we say that, but as I suggested, I think there are fewer Americans who have served themselves. There are fewer Americans who have a family member who have served or are serving, and we're getting to the point where there probably would be a lot of people who would say, you know, I don't even know anyone. I don't have any friends, acquaintances, coworkers who have been in the military.
No, that's correct.
So do you think, as some people have suggested, that in this country we are developing, in a sense, two different cultures, a military culture, a civilian culture, and that the kind of gulf between them, if you just look at that bare fact of having served or having any connection at all to the military, do you think that in fact we are developing these two groups within American society?
Well, it would be really too bad if that were to happen, but I'm not really so worried about that. Mm-hmm. I think the problem is more subtle than that. But mm-hmm. were we to have a sort of a militarist society where you have military people, non-military people, I think that would be really unfortunate. In fact, the military tends to reflect civilian values rather well. If you have a society as we had in the Vietnam War that is relaxed about illegal drug use and such, no one should be surprised that that finds its way into the military. If you find a society that's more conservative in other ways, religiously perhaps, that finds its way into the military. If you have a society that is more accepting of various alternative lifestyles, then you find that that's, that same kind of tolerance finds its way into the military as well.
Well, let me ask you this question, because I think that there are some people who would say that while, you know, it may be that the values of the two groups are not that much different. If you look at their demographics, you look at particularly people who serve in the military, you look at their background, their ethnicity, their level of education, at their particularly socioeconomic class status,
yeah, that's the
all,
big
all
one
those
there.
Sorts of things, that then people would say that that in those respects, that the military is not a reflection of the whole of society. Is that a fair thing?
Well, it depends which one you're looking at. Clearly, it is true that elites do not participate in the military at all reflective of their numbers, and that they, in fact, are not contributing as they perhaps ought to the society's defense that benefits them so much. Geographically, you find that the military is predominantly, more south than it is the other, northeast in particular, northeast being the least well-represented, south being the best. Most underrepresented group is clearly military. About half the population of the age group that you would be recruiting, 18 to 24, is female. But women provide about 16% of the accessions to the enlisted ranks and are only 14% of the active duty enlisted force. But there is an upward trend in this. Racially, many people are not aware of this, I think, but the representation is really not that bad. African-American accessions, for example, are 13% of active duty accessions, compared with 14% in the civilian population of that same age group, 18 to 24. Now, in fact, they're overrepresented in the force because they have higher retention rates. And so in the force in total, you have 20%, then now looking at a career ages 18 to 44 versus 13% of the civilian. So that's really not too far off. Probably Hispanics are somewhat underrepresented in the force. But again, the racial disparity is really not that bad.
Mm-hmm. For it seems to me that for some of the people who do make this argument that there is this kind of gulf between the military and the people who are connected to it and the people who aren't, that there is this also the suggestion, and it may tell you something about the orientation of the people who are concerned about this, I don't know, but there is this suggestion that in fact that American society is, a majority of American society is anti-military. Now, you might well ask, well, what does that mean? That could mean a variety of things. But let me just ask the question that way and ask you, do you think that a significant number of Americans are anti-military?
Well, short answer, no. The paragraph instead of the snippet. Lots of Americans do not like the purposes for which the military is being used. There's not much support for the Iraq War, for example, as there was earlier, although the surge appears to be, at least in the short run, working. We'll see how that plays out. But of course, this has all gotten up into a political campaign, so any relation between what is reported and what the truth is an accident. But in fact, people do support the idea of a military. They support the military in the abstract. And, very interestingly, and quite unlike when I was on active duty in the Vietnam era and shortly after, they do support military people.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a change. It's a big change from Vietnam, when soldiers would come back from Vietnam into the expected embrace of a society that appreciated what they did and finding themselves demonized and even attacked in the airport. So that is a huge change.
Well, and I think this is something that's very interesting, and that is, it certainly seems to be true, that at least is during our lifetimes, and maybe even a larger time frame, the high watermark of anti-military sentiment would have been during the Vietnam War, not only many people opposed the war, but that the negative feelings toward the war also attached to the people who were fighting the war.
Precisely.
At least, certainly, many soldiers would say that their experience confirmed that. Now, what seems to be interesting, something that has happened since, is that many people, people certainly who oppose, let us say, just talk about the Iraq War, who oppose the Iraq War tend to draw a distinction between the war, the people who decided to fight the war, and the people who are fighting the war. And,
right.
You know, if I walk down the street and I see in somebody's front yard a sign that says, support the troops, end the war,
right.
This does not seem to me to be necessarily anti-military. And I think that that's an interesting distinction now that people seem to be drawing. And I wonder, why has that happened, and why is it that there seems to be support for the troops at the same time that there are a lot of people who would say, but I think that it was a mistake to send them to the place that we sent them?
Right. This is probably the most interesting question in civil-military relations, and I'm glad we got onto it fast. First, there have been some changes since Vietnam. The first is, Vietnam was a war and for which there was no apparent justification at all, other than some very strange notions about domino theories and that kind of thing. Now, the Iraq War might have been a misbegotten effort from the beginning, but there is a threat out there, and people see it. After 9/11, I no longer have to convince my students there's a whole lot of people out there who are trying to kill as many of us as they can. That really does tend to clarify the mind. Now, that doesn't mean that a particular response is a good one. And even people who think the Iraq War is not only a bad idea, but it's a monumental distraction from other things that we ought to be doing. Some of those other things that they'd like to do are, in fact, military, like spend more time in Afghanistan, or we let Osama bin Laden get away in many views because of preoccupation elsewhere. That's a little simplistic. But I think also we learned our lesson after Vietnam. We were kind of embarrassed, I think, by the way that we treated the troops. Other thing, I think, is that a lot of, quote-unquote, doves discovered in the 90s that you need peacekeeping troops for international hotspots, whether Kosovo or whatever. It is very, very useful to have military force. In fact, it's unavoidable. One of my friends, Elliot Cohen, who's an analyst at a professor at Johns Hopkins, talked about the ornithological miracle by which the doves had become hawks. Well, they were in the context of peacekeeping, but it's a fact. You simply have to have credible military forces if you're going to have peacekeeping. If you only pretend to have them, as the UN did in Bosnia, then you have situations like Srebrenica, where 5,000-plus men and boys were murdered because the UN was unable to protect them.
Let me just, again, very quickly introduce again our guest here, John Allen Williams. He's professor of political science at Loyola University, Chicago. He's also chair and president of the Inter-University Seminar on Armed Forces and Society. He has written on civil-military relations and military culture, as well as strategic policy. And we're talking this morning about civilian-military relations in the United States. Questions are welcome. Questions, comments, welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. I'm going back to this idea, raising this question of, is there some kind of a gulf in this country, conceptual, between the civilian world and the military, and between people who have some connection to the military and people who don't. And it may be that that's not as great a gulf as some people would say. But assuming that there is maybe some kind of disconnect, or at least that we have people, a lot of people who have no connection to the military, does that then translate at all into either the willingness of our political leadership, and I guess mostly I'm thinking about Congress, to support the use of military force, or then the willingness of the general population to support the use of military force?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. I think political elites might be more careful about the use of force if it was their kids that were going. Hmm. They're not. So you send other people's kids. That is very troubling. In fact, data from the Triangle Institute of Strategic Studies, who did this famous Bridging the Gap project, Peter Feaver and Richard Cohn, showed that the percentage of, if there's a higher percentage of veterans in Congress, the congressional actions are likely to be less militarist than if the percentage is lower. If you have a lot of military people, or others would say, "Well, gee, you know, people aren't in the military, so they're gonna hate it." Well, that's learning the wrong lessons from Vietnam. In fact, the danger, and you hinted at it, is that if you haven't been in the military, you might in fact grow to love it too much, and expect that military forces can do things that they really can't and shouldn't be used for, or you have expectation of military being able to accomplish things that it cannot. Take, for example, the notion of surgical strike. There is no such thing as a surgical strike. Every strike has collateral damage. I don't think doctors can make a surgical strike on your tonsils without something collateral going on. But, boy, if you're going to be putting military forces into an area, it better be important enough that you're willing to take casualties, and you're willing to inflict casualties, and you're willing to absorb the moral costs of the death of innocents, because that is absolutely going to happen when you do that.
Well, do you think, and this may indeed be a matter of personal opinion, I'm not sure how one really answers a question like this, but do you, in a sense, we've talked around it, do you think that it is the case that it would be that someone who had seen military service, particularly someone who had actually seen combat, that they would be less eager to commit troops to combat because they know what it's like, and the reverse, that someone who has no idea what that's like might find it easier in their mind to send American soldiers to be in harm's way?
I don't know about the last half of that, but the first half of that is true. I think that people who have been in the military, especially those unlike me, who have in fact been in combat, are very unlikely to, or much less likely to, want to insert the military in situations. However, once the military is inserted, they would be more likely to support a very strenuous effort to end the war quickly as possible and on favorable terms.
One, we talked a little earlier about the how military attitudes, or that is, how attitudes of the general population toward the military have changed since Vietnam. Certainly one of the big differences, one of the big changes, is that during the time of Vietnam there was a draft, and now we have a volunteer. Some people say all volunteer, and I think other people say, well, it's perhaps more correct to say that what we have is an all-recruited military, not
that's
necessarily
correct.
An all-volunteer military.
That's
but,
right. They don't
but,
just pop in.
That's right.
Recruited.
That's right. But how much do you think the absence of the draft today and the fact that it is indeed a recruited force has to do with how people feel about it?
Oh, I'm sure it makes a difference. One reason the Nixon administration ended it in 1973 was exactly to turn down the heat on the protests. It absolutely has a difference. And by the way, it's ironic that you have an all-recruited force, yet you have people who in the abstract think that a military is useful, but yet will put impediments in the way of military recruiters having access to high school students or even college students.
Talk more about that and why you think that that's a problem.
Well, it's a huge problem if the military can't at least present its alternatives to high school kids, because that's who the military needs to recruit. Now, people say, well, you know, recruiters are sometimes dishonest. Yeah, they are, and they shouldn't do that, and if they are, they ought to be punished. But that's a separate argument. If you want to have a military, there is no argument that they need to be able to recruit. Otherwise, you're not going to have one. Now, if you say, well, you know, I just don't like recruiters, well, okay, that's fine, then maybe we don't have a military. Let's go back to that. Because it isn't going to happen spontaneously unless you have some kind of compulsion. Now, we have the all-recruited volunteer force that we have now is actually creaking along and working fairly well, but it's working in an environment never intended to work in. To be able to support the kind of military deployments that we have now, without any kind of draft, was not imagined when the AVF came along.
Well, this gets us into perhaps another area, and I promise I have a caller here I want to get right to, and that is that there now the deployments in Iraq and Afghanistan have produced a great strain on the military, and they're having difficulty getting enough troops, meeting their recruiting targets, and they have made a number of changes in what it is they require of people.
That's true.
But the question is this a, in a sense, is just this a blip that's made necessary by the commitment that we're making now, and that we're going to say, well, that's not likely to happen all that often, so really we don't have to address this? Or is it indeed something that we have to address and that we have to find some ways, new ways perhaps, to entice people to join?
Well, we have clearly a strategy force mismatch. We don't have the forces large enough to handle the strategy and the commitments that we have for it. And so you have not only the army that's being people going back for repetitive tours in Iraq and Afghanistan, but you have a reserve force, National Guard forces, which were never called up in Vietnam, never. Even in that war, Lyndon Johnson would not call them up because it would remind people that, hey, there's a war on. Well, guess what? After Vietnam, the Army reinvented itself.
Professor Williams, I think perhaps we might have lost the guest. I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll see if we can get hooked up again with him, and we'll continue our conversation. It'll give me an opportunity to introduce again John Allen Williams. He's professor of political science at Loyola University Chicago. He also is chair and president of the Inter-University Seminar on Armed Forces and Society. He's a visiting scholar in the Department of Sociology at Northwestern University. He is also co-organizer and past president of the International Security and Arms Control Section of the American Political Science Association. He's written on civil-military relations and military culture, as well as strategic policy defense organization. He's joining us this morning by telephone. He's also a retired captain in the U.S. Naval Reserve. Questions here are welcome, and we have a couple of people to bring into the conversation. We'll go to someone here, line number one. This is Champaign County to start us off. Hello.
Hi, we're together here?
Yes.
My whole broader view of this is I want to go back to the general that my father idolized, and that's Eisenhower and the warning against the military-industrial complex. I think we should take that to heart more than ever. And when the U.S. is spending, half again more than the rest of the world combined on military expense, it's demonstrable that we have a definite problem. And the encroachment with the Northern Command, where the Posse Comitatus has been sort of suspended. I mean, I'm not joining Ron Paul here, but I think there's a lot of sentiment against encroachment on many aspects of life by the military. That you can honor the warrior and still not like the war, and you can not like the recourse to war. In Chicago, we have this situation where there are these military academies all over Chicago now, and mostly in, well, actually not all over. They're mostly in the minority areas, and I think it's 90% minority in enrollment, and this sort of has just crept up on us, it seems. There's a long history of private military academies for drying people out and being a place for problem teenagers, mainly males in those days, but this seems to me unprecedented, and I just think we need to step up and not be worried about being cast as simply anti-military when we want to ask questions about all of these items.
Well,
that's not a question, but I'd like to.
Those are good topics. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, Professor Williams, go ahead and comment.
Yeah, I didn't hear anything anti-military in anything the caller said. There are three particular topics. I'd like to give you a paragraph on each very quickly. On the military-industrial complex, it is absolutely true that weapon systems acquire their own constituency in Congress, usually, and it's really kind of hard to stop them once they're going. And so you have the Air Force in particular buying all kinds of legacy systems of expensive aircraft and such that are useful for, in case the Russians start stirring again, but not that useful in the kind of wars that we're likely to face. On the military academies, the civilian academies for underprivileged kids, these are just a flat, slam-bang great idea. They tend not, the kids who go through these tend not to go in the military, but they tend to benefit tremendously from the kind of discipline that these retired officers and others instill in them. The same is true of junior ROTC programs. And a lot of people who went into teaching because they didn't like the military in the Vietnam War, didn't want to go into it themselves, are conflicted because they don't like the military much, but yet it's doing great things for the underprivileged children and kids that they really care a lot about. So I think those are just great ideas. Now, posse comitatus, as you know, of course, is that 1878 law that essentially prevents federal troops from being used as police forces except in extraordinary cases. There are exceptions, emergencies, national emergencies, and the National Guard, as long as it's being under state control, is in fact can be used as police force. The problem is that the kinds of challenge that we face, for example, enforcing a quarantine in case of a biological attack, is going to fall upon the military, and this is going to become a big strain on posse comitatus issues. I'm not aware what the Northern Command is up to, what the caller is responding to, but the whole notion of using military forces domestically is going to be something we have to think through very, very carefully.
I don't think it's a slam dunk about the military academies. The PBS NewsHour had a rather mixed report on how effective they've actually been. It's also true that a lot of people chime in and say that the boot camp solution that we have a Lincoln Challenge quite close to here has been very effective, and that's not documented either. That is not the case according to the studies that have been coming out lately. But there still seems to be a great attachment to this as a solution, and I just don't see it. The Guard has been used in California to spy on people. One of the chief people was forced to resign because of the scandal that broke about it. It's not widely talked about. It's not, you can't find a lot when you Google search about it. But this was to get around posse comitatus in a way that they. So I just.
But he was caught and cashiered, I gather.
But he managed to not get his. The details of it are on Daily Kos and not very many other places. He was caught, but he was not thoroughly investigated because he did not surrender his hard drive or something to that effect. So that,
no, I think I need to know more about that from someplace other than the Daily Kos. But
I don't actually find it a very good source either. But when nobody else covers it, one has to. I keep bringing it up on military-related shows, even though it may be tangentially related.
Well, no, you need to do that. In fact, if you find more data on that, you can find me and send it to me, because I'd be really interested to know. Because when that kind of thing happens, that's very, very dangerous. I mean, look, the first line of defense, let's face it, against the threat that we face is, in fact, intelligence. It needs to be good. Whatever else we do, it needs to be effective. Well, if it's effective, it's going to be enormously intrusive and therefore dangerous. So we are on the horns of a dilemma here. And the more effective it is, the more dangerous it is. So I'm not quite sure what the solution is because, the checks and balances of Federalist 51 don't work in this situation.
I'm going to jump in here. I hope the caller will forgive me because I have a couple of others here who are lined up and waiting, and I'd like to get them in as well and go next to someone in Effingham. This is line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
I'm not in Effingham.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm your Belgium caller.
You're in Belgium. Okay, go ahead.
Yes, sir. I would like to get back to your aspect of the military and all. And I'd like to point out that the last presidential child that died in a war was Theodore Roosevelt's son and died in World War II. FDR's son was one of the raiders that was involved in the Philippines or something like that. And he was probably the last of the presidential children that actually saw combat, when it gets down to getting combat. Our present president, whose father was in in a war. His son almost went to war, but he didn't quite make it. Now, if we really sat down and said the first person that goes to war is a president's child, I bet you'd see a lot less wars. You know what I mean?
Oh, I'd love to see that. And in terms of recruiting, I've been happier if the Bush children and, you know, Chelsea Clinton and others, you know, signed up for the Army. That would help recruitment a lot.
I think it would reduce the number of wars we have completely, sir.
That too.
You know, they would soon say, you know what, I don't think I want to risk my family.
Well, that's right.
I
think they're willing to do it for a cause that's significant enough. I mean, these people are, you know, I can't criticize people's patriotism, but I find there's a lot of people on both sides of the aisle who had other things to do when they had the opportunity to serve the country and yet are quite willing to send other people's children into harm's way.
That's precisely what I'm talking about, sir. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. But again, that gets back to the. And we've talked a little bit about this before. That does indeed get back to this very question. Well, suppose that you are the president of the United States, and you have a child, could be now son or daughter. You could have one of each in the military, and you could know that you, if you're making a decision to send the troops, that it's possible that you could be sending your child into combat, and your child could die. So then the question is: all right, does that make you as the president of the United States any less eager, any more reluctant to commit American troops if you have that personal stake in the outcome? And I guess I'm not so sure that it does.
Well, presidents are human, but of course the problem is actually even greater than that. It isn't just that the general public has not had a close, you know, connection with war. The political leaders don't, but the congressmen don't, but also the congressional staffers that help draft legislation and choose positions, help the congressmen sort out positions. The military elites, the elites in the media. In fact, the embedding of reporters in the war was probably the best thing to happen for military reporting in a long time. You put these men and women in danger, and they started writing articles about our soldiers and we, because they're being protected by these men and women. It's a huge difference. Plus, they're going to actually understand something about the military and what it's like to be a soldier.
Well, let me now just very quickly, let me follow up on that comment, because you said this was the best thing to happen for military reporting in a long time. I think, though, that some people would raise the issue that, in fact, what happened was that the fact that the reporters were personally involved, their lives were at risk as well. They established some sort of relationship with the soldiers that were with them, and it probably would be a good thing and a natural thing that happened, that it meant that their reporting was perhaps more pro-military or more favorable toward the military or reflect the military point of view more than it would have otherwise. So when you say this was good for military reporting, do you mean that that's good for reporting or it's good for the military?
Well, both. I mean, let's give the people who read things and watch reports some credit. They understand what's going on. It certainly might be a nice counterbalance to a reflexive anti-militarism that you see in a lot of the media sources.
And do you think that is, in fact, there? A reflexive anti-media sentiment?
Of course I do.
Let's go next to Champagne. This is Lyme.
No, not everywhere. I mean, there are a lot of people who really get it. I mean, there are people like Tom Ricks, who's not been in the military, who is a brilliant reporter, and he called out the administration on the Iraq War in his book Fiasco. So, you know, some people get it.
All right. Let's talk with someone in Champagne next. This is line number two. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to bring... sort of bring up a tangential point which you raised, which was the military-industrial complex, and I'd like to just make a comment and hear what you have to say. It happens in today's paper, in the New York Times, there was an article about earmarks, specifically in connection to Representative Murtha, who is had several hundred million dollars of earmarks that he had most of them military earmarks to companies in his district, all of which made donations to his campaign. And he, of course, is one of the top leaders in the Democratic Party. in Congress. So I wanted you to talk a little about this, bipartisan military-industrial complex. And one further point on that, and I'll hang up and listen to your comments off the air. The article also mentioned that because of Representative Murtha's, important role as the head of the committee that many military officials have to come to, they're not able to refuse or challenge projects that he wants, which they don't think would be militarily appropriate, useful, et cetera, et cetera. So I'd like to hear your comments on that.
Well, the problem of earmarks and porks is every bit as bad in the Democratic Party as it is in the Republican Party. So this isn't a party thing. The caller is referring to an editorial on the New York Times, which I just pulled up. It says, "The Pork King Keeps His Crown," which I think is a title that Mr. Murtha has richly earned. And because he was in the Marine Corps once, he's confused with someone who knows something, has special knowledge about military strategy. So I have to say that I've not been a huge fan of Representative Murtha, and I'm sort of going to enjoy reading this editorial.
Well, this perhaps leads one to think about the characterization, the generalization, the broad brush painting that says, well, the party of the military is the Republican Party.
And, no, that's just not true. In fact, in terms of being willing to support military people and veterans and such, the Democratic Party has acquitted itself very well. In fact, in some instances, better than the Republicans. So, and that would be really too bad if one party or the other were to become identified with one party. Now, as it happens, a greater percentage of people in the military are conservative than are in the general population. But that would be true of middle managers at IBM, too. And until this acquires a partisan political cast, then I think there's really not really anything to worry about.
Hmm. Our guest in this hour, let me just introduce again, is John Allen Williams. He's professor of political science at Loyola University Chicago. He has written a lot about civil-military relations and military culture, as well as strategic policy. He retired as captain in the U.S. Naval Reserve with 30 years of commissioned service. He's also visiting scholar in the Department of Sociology at Northwestern and is co-organizer and past president of the International Security and Arms Control Section of the American Political Science Association. We're talking about civilian-military relations in the U.S. At least that's where we started. We've gotten into some different areas, but that's been the main focus here of the conversation. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have some other callers here in Urbana. The next in line is line number one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I'm a military parent, and there are three members of my family who are serving currently. And I've done a lot of reading on this, because this has been something, this disconnect has been an issue that I think has touched me and a lot of the other military families that I know and our young people that are serving. From what I've read, approximately 1% of our population makes up our military force, only 1%. And according to your original question, I think if you live in a community that has a base nearby or has a lot of military presence, you may not feel the disconnect as much as if you live in a community like ours that no longer has a base close by. As far as the numbers serving, I think that the percentages are more heavy on certain socioeconomic levels than others, and I don't know if you touched on that. I didn't catch all of what you were saying at the beginning about who does and who doesn't serve. But from what I've read, most of the people that are in our leadership in our country do not have family members serving, so they're in that category where they're deciding for other people's children to go, or other people's family members to go. As a parent, when we've had deployments to deal with, it has been a very bizarre reality. Our reality is that we're worried about life and death kinds of issues with our kids where they are. And the other people that we deal with, unless they're military families also, for the most part, our close friends are understanding and sympathetic. But most of the people that we deal with in our community, their lives don't touch on this at all. They don't care about it seemingly at all. They would rather not hear about it. They would rather not talk about it. It's as though their world doesn't involve this at all, and our world involves life and death kinds of things, and we're seeing our kids sacrifice hugely and in great danger, and the rest of our world here doesn't acknowledge it. So that's been a real problem, and I think that's the core of the disconnect that I see. And with the kind of war that we have right now, I think there's a fine line. Our kids, our family members who go and volunteer to serve our country, do it with the expectation of sacrifice. That's part of it. You want to do it for the right reasons. You want to help. You want to make a difference. You want to you know that you'll have to sacrifice in order to do all those things. But I think there's a fine line that has been crossed, and that they're expected to serve over and over and over again. They're being overextended. They're being shorted on the materials that they need to be successful. They're being shorted on supplies. They're being asked to be exposed to things that are just horrible. And they're living in conditions that are terrible. And then they're being sent back there over and over again. And there's no one to take their place. Their people aren't coming in. And I am really concerned at that line that's been crossed. I'm also concerned because if we have a finite number of people serving and we have more happen domestically, like another Katrina, or more happen internationally where we need to find troops, even more is going to be asked of them because there's no one waiting in the wings to come in and help. And I'm very, very concerned about that. That's a very big issue. And in World War II, people, everyone sacrificed. Everyone was willing to ration. People stepped in and did whatever they could to support the war effort. And now the only thing that I have read that's been asked of the general public is to go shopping and keep the economy strong. And I think that's really, really a sad commentary on our society. And so I see a big disconnect, and I see a lot that's wrong with what's happening now. And I would really like for more people to acknowledge and appreciate and take this war into their homes, into their thoughts, into their hearts, and understand what's being sacrificed by a lot of people in their name. And so I'm really glad that you're talking about this. I'm kind of sorry that some of these other issues have been brought in too, because I think this issue is huge. It may not affect everyone, maybe just the family of the 1%, but it's huge for some of us. So thank you very much, and I don't know if you want to comment on that, but I'll get off and listen.
Don't get off yet, please. Please don't, because I want to ask you something, if I may. I could not have put this more eloquently than the caller just did. We talk about it as a society of the importance of fairness. Well, everything that the caller said is completely accurate, and to what extent is that fair? That we expect that kind of sacrifice for a relatively few number of people. May I ask, are your family members who are in the military, are they in a National Guard or Reserve component or
no.
active? They're in the active component?
Yes.
Yeah. It's a problem because although the spouses may be on or near a military base, the extended family is not. And it is a problem for National Guard forces. And I noticed that the Illinois National Guard has a deployment warning for Iraq, I think. The reserve forces are taken out of their jobs, and they aren't anywhere near a military base for such succor as that could be. So I have nothing to say except to thank you for what you and your family are doing for our country.
Well, thank you very much for focusing on this and bringing it out so that more people are aware of the problem because, as I said, some of us feel this very keenly, and others of us don't feel it at all. And I think, I know life's not fair, but I think if they're fighting for all of us, if they're serving for all of us in whatever capacity they're serving, because a lot of people are not in a combat kind of situation, but in whatever way they're serving, I think that they deserve a huge thank you. They do not deserve to come home and be ignored or be patronized or passed over and not honestly dealt with and not honestly appreciated for what they've done. And I think there are so many families that have made huge sacrifices. I have the privilege of knowing about 5 Gold Star families. And I can't imagine the reality of what they've lived through and what they're still living through and what they will for the rest of their lives live through. And these sacrifices are being taken for granted by the rest of our country. And I think sometimes people don't intend to do that. I think they get busy with their lives and it doesn't affect their lives because their lives go on just the same. But these people's lives will never be the same. The people that come back injured and have to deal with new challenges physically and the family members of those people, these people's lives will always be different. And I want people to understand that, and I want people to show more compassion and show more care, because this is a huge sacrifice. And even those that come back without injuries that show, a lot come back with injuries that don't show, and a lot come back, thankfully, with no injuries at all, and that come back healthy in every way, but they still have sacrificed a lot. And I think we need to be more aware of this. We need to be more vocal in our appreciation. So thank you again.
Well, I would invite the caller to contact me offline. I'd enjoy continuing this conversation.
Let me then ask you this, Grant. Obviously, now the question is, if one believes that the fact that the burden of national defense is falling on this very small percentage of the American public and their families, and that it falls lightly, if at all, on anybody else, then what do you do about that?
Well, it's always going to, there are two issues. First, what percentage of the population do you really need to serve, more than we have now, to solve some of the problems that the caller so eloquently discussed? In some respect, it's always going to be an unequal sacrifice, because you don't need now everybody to serve. And so given that you need a relatively small proportion to serve, how do you select them? And is there any kind of compulsion involved with that, or is it just simply the marketplace? So the burden is always going to be somewhat unequal. I do think that in terms of race, it isn't the issue so much. I think in terms of social class, it is.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with someone else here. Line number two, this is Champagne. Hello. Is there a caller there, too, Champagne?
Line two, yes.
Yes, okay. Go ahead. Yes.
I'll try to be brief. Well, I want to say that we live continually in a socially constructed reality. Any society you have is going to be that, and we have to examine the fundamental values of our society and the structure of it. I think that rather than a specific contrast between civilian and military, what we have is an imbalance weighted in favor of the ruling class that has control, almost total control of our society, of our media and so forth, as well as, you know, the law enforcement and the judiciary, the whole government. Well, anyone who would like to begin to reexamine our history of this nation, I think I'd refer them to Martin Scorsese's two movies. One is The Gangs of New York. It's a very suppressed social history that this is about. And the other is a counterpoint, The Age of Innocence, which begins in 1970, and it's a very nice romance, but it shows very clearly that the plutocrats who were already, you know, in control of American society and were entirely in collusion with the European aristocracy and had become just like them. And our military cannot liberate another country because it's not liberated, because they serve the wrong class. And until our entire society begins to have a dialogue on these matters, we're not going to get anywhere. And nothing has changed since the Middle Ages as far as the ruling class harvests the lower classes and anybody else who's willing to do its fighting for.
We're very short on time here, and I don't know if we'll be able to include another caller, and you can reflect on what the caller had to say any way you like.
My reading of history is so different from the caller's assumptions that I would know where to begin. It is clear that we need to make the society more fair and more honest and other things, but I think some of the claims of the caller were quite extreme.
I guess I find myself going back to at least this idea that that there is a class distinction between the political leadership in the country and the most of the people who serve in the military, and is that in fact a problem or not?
Well, I think the problem is that I'm still thinking about what that two callers ago said, or three callers ago, the really eloquent comments of that lady talking about the unequal sacrifice. That is absolutely, absolutely correct. And the fact that people are not under any compulsion to, for example, serve in the military to get the benefits for college, I think where we're going to end up is what I've called supplemented volunteerism. We're going to have an all-recruited force, but I could see some kind of national service, civilian and military, by which people who wish certain government benefits would pay for those benefits by participation in our public life, whether as VISTA volunteers or some kind of alternative service, or perhaps in the military itself. That's, I think, where we might end up.
Well, here,
I have no problem with that.
We're almost at the point we have to finish, and you touch on an important point, and you know maybe that's something that's worth another entire program, and that is that's the idea, and many people would agree that it would be a good thing for there to be some kind of national service, not necessarily being in the military, but some kind of national service. And
we don't need that many people in the military. The national service is no problem.
And some people would hope that people would that is young people or maybe not necessarily young people would do it. Because they thought it was a good thing to do. It sounds as if you're saying that to move in that direction, you would have to provide some kind of incentive. You couldn't just rely on as long as it was voluntary, you couldn't just rely on people doing it out of the goodness of their hearts. You're going to have to give them some reason to do it.
Well, I mean, if it's voluntary, if you want government benefits under my idea, but let's face it, a certain number of people that go into the military are going to like it. I went into the Navy in the Vietnam War. I didn't expect to love it. I didn't expect to spend 30 years. I mean, I was happy enough to do it. My mother was in the Navy in World War II, so that wasn't a problem. But without the threat of the draft, I wasn't going to do it. And so I think there may be other people like me out there that might find it's more congenial than they realize it's going to be.
Well, at that, we're going to finish up with our thanks to our guest, John Allen Williams. He's professor of political science at Loyola University, Chicago. He's also a visiting scholar in the Department of Sociology, Northwestern. He's the co-organizer, past president of the International Security and Arms Control Section of the American Political Science Association, and writes on, among other things, civil-military relations and strategic policy. Professor Williams, thanks very much.
My pleasure.